Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, providing more than 41,000 jobs in the production of wood pallets, railroad ties, white oak barrels, hardwood floors, and more. Details at choosewood.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. 55 years ago, St. Louis high schooler Tom Hartman had a dream to record original music with his band, the Aerovons, at the same place his beloved Beatles did. And that dream came true when he and his bandmates got the chance to lay down tracks like this one called Everything's All Right at EMI Recording Studios in London in 1969. Unfortunately, the Aerovons never got their due. Their album, recorded in the studio adjacent to where the Beatles were recording Abbey Road, went unreleased after the band fell apart and the studio made questionable promotional decisions. The Aerovons' legend did continue to grow even after their breakup, and bootleg CD copies of their songs were passed around Beatles devotees across England by the turn of the century. So the St. Louis band's work never made it to vinyl. But that's finally about to change. A remastered version of their album, Resurrection, is set for release by Euclid Records on April 20th. Fun fact, 420 is Record Store Day. And joining us to talk about the decades-long road to this achievement and what it means to have his work recognized now, we welcome Tom Hartman, leader of the Aerovons. Tom, thanks for being with us today, and congratulations.
Thanks for having me, Elaine, and hello, St. Louis.
So, Tom, when did your love for the Beatles begin?
Actually, it began. My family tended to watch the news at night, and Walter Cronkite on CBS featured a story on what was going on over in England back then, and it was Beatlemania. And they showed a clip of the Beatles playing She Loves You. And I had already been playing guitar for a year or two and was into the Beach Boys and other groups. So I recognized that they really sounded different, and I couldn't stop talking about them. And about a month later, my mom came home from the store and said, "That group you keep talking about is going to be on KXOK tonight at 7:30. They're going to play their new single." That was "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and that was it for me.
And you were just 11 or 12 at the time?
Yeah, I was very young.
So what was it, Tom, that you were so enamored of when it came to their sound?
It was... You know, I often tell people the best way to discover what I was hearing is to maybe do some research and download or listen to the top 20, say, records about a week or two before I Want to Hold Your Hand came out, and it will give you an idea. I think one of the number one records was called Dominique by the Singing Nun. So when I Want to Hold Your Hand came out, as a budding young fan of guitar, I was just blown away by the sound itself of their guitars. It seems like, you know, previous to that, guitars and pop music seemed to get featured when a solo came up or something like that. But during the vocals and all that, they were very tame and in the background. And it wasn't that way. I Don't Want to Hold Your Hand. It was just blazing from moment one. Mm-hmm. And so that's what knocked me out.
Yeah. Was there, Tom, a Beatle that you most wanted to be like?
Well, I mean, I don't know why, but right off the bat, I was... just enamored of George, I guess, because he had a big Gretsch and played lead guitar, and he looked kind of even to me as a young kid, he looked what I imagined an English person would look like on the I Want to Hold Your Hand single cover. Mm-hmm. So I was very impressed with George.
Mm-hmm. And how is it that the Beatles affected your aspirations? I mean, did you want to become a star in their order after seeing them and experiencing what their music was like?
You know, absolutely not. And a lot of people find it odd, but I can't speak for the other guys in the group who have sadly passed away at this point. But it was never my goal to be rich and famous. And mm-hmm. that's just part of my kind of naivety, I guess, as a kid. I wanted to write music and hear it recorded under those same circumstances. Mm-hmm. And if other people liked it and money came in and we got, you know, famous or had a couple of hits, that would be grand. Yeah. But it's weird, but it really wasn't the motivating factor. I mm-hmm. just wanted to get over there. If a dream came true and be in that same kind of environment with the top engineers and the oddness of the sound of their studio, which stuck out over other records at the time.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into a bit of the story about the band. In 1966, you formed the Aerovons, and you started playing gigs and doing some recordings here in St. Louis. Now, how is it that led to you and your bandmates eventually traveling to London in 1968 with your demo tape?
Well, it's kind of it's almost like a story out of a bad 50s rock and roll movie. It's like pretty unbelievable. But, you know, my mother had managed the group and had gotten us to play at all the top places at the time in St. Louis. We even did a seventh inning stretch at Busch Stadium during a Cardinal game.
Oh.
And so we had played everywhere from little clubs and CYCs and high school dances to Busch Stadium. And at one point she just said, you know, guys, you really need to do a demo of a song that you've written. She was learning on the job too. And she said to me, from what I can gather, that's the ticket. So we actually, a friend donated a piano, and it was brought over to where we were living at the time. And I just banged around on it and wrote this song called World of You. And we got, I think it was all of $250 or something together, and went down to a studio in St. Louis called Premiere. And couple old guys that were used to doing voiceover recording for commercials and things like that. So they had never seen a band come in, a rock band come in. And we did this demo. And about a week later, they called us and they said, you know, Capitol Records has a distribution center here in St. Louis. And one of the guys dropped by and we played what we recorded of you guys and they loved it. So they're going to be calling you. So in short, they did, and they just said that they felt like some people they could connect us with at Capitol in California would be interested in hearing this thing. And being the dumb, naive dreamer I was at 16 or whatever I was, I said, Mom, I want to record in England where the Beatles do. And the Beatles, you know, EMI owned Capitol, so there was a connection there. And the guy was a little taken aback, but he said, well, if that's the case, there's a man named Roy Featherstone you can contact in London at EMI and, you know, tell him we referred you. And take it from there, and good luck. And that's how it happened.
Yeah. I think this is a great time to give people a taste of what those folks heard at the record company. This is World of You.
It's a new world of you, and I'm just a stranger here. It's a new thing to do, and I'm being quite sincere. Though I know
and again, that is the Aravans performing World of You. So, Tom, I mean, hearing that, I got to underscore that this is a song that was written when you were about 15 or 16 years old.
16.
Yeah. And, I mean, I can see why there was interest, but I want to get back to a point that you'd made about your mom. Like, it could have been, like, a mother who loves what her son is doing and wants to get it out there. But there's a little bit more to it than that, right? How was your mom really part of getting you the opportunity that would eventually, you know, take you to London to record the song?
Well, it wasn't because I wanted my mom to be manager, that's for sure. it was kind of embarrassing, really, you know, but the group was... She was extremely persuasive and could talk her way into anything. And she had had a kind of disappointing experience when she was a young kid. She had a great voice and wanted to go out on the road with kind of, you know, Benny Goodman style bands and stuff. And my grandma, her mother said, "No way, you're not going out on the road." So I think she was, you know, a little bit living vicariously through me to do things that she was denied to be able to do. And when the band heard that she was offering to help get us booked around town to some of the better clubs and events that were going on, I was like, you know, "Mom, just can you bring us another soda or something?" And they were like, "Tom, leave her alone. Let her do it." And, you know, soon enough, we were booked everywhere. She just had a knack for it, could talk her way into things like that Busch Stadium 7th inning stretch and some other things. So that's how she took over being the manager and booking agent for us. But by the same token, she just had her own, you know, chutzpah and no experience in it. So she was learning on the job just like we were.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and so that kind of, when she learned that, you know, probably the best thing to do at this point was to write your own song and get it recorded and take it somewhere, that's how that all got going. And once we took that demo over to London to Roy Featherstone at EMI. He listened to it and he said, "Well, I would do a single on that." And he said, "I'm very impressed that a group from St. Louis wants to come all the way over to London to record." He said, "Most of our artists want to get out of here and go to America to record." So it was kind of funny. So I think they thought, even Rolling Stone magazine at the time had a one-liner about us getting signed. And it said, "St. Louis's Aravans get signed to EMI Records London, a real man bites dog act." Mm-hmm. So it was unusual for a U.S. group to go over. I know Jimi Hendrix had done it, but it was not the norm.
Right. We're talking with Tom Hartman, band leader of the Aravans, which got its start in St. Louis in the late 1960s. This month, 55 years after they recorded their first album at EMI Studios in London, in the studio, again, that was right next to the one where the Beatles recorded Abbey Road, their work is finally being released on vinyl. So this is a great segue to what happened when you got to London. You met the Beatles during the 1968 trip. Specifically, was both Paul McCartney and George Harrison.
Yeah.
How did that unfold?
Well, I mean, and you really have to understand there's, you know, millions of Beatles fans in the world, but I was certainly at the top of being one of them. And so going from your living room in 1964 and watching them on Ed Sullivan to being in London and meeting them was just, it was, you know, it was otherworldly. And we, you know, we had been asked on that first trip to London, when they signed us, they kind of jokingly said, so have you been seeing a lot of London at night? Have you been to the clubs, which they called discos back then? Mm-hmm. And we said, yeah. They said, have you been to Speakeasy? And I said, we tried, but we couldn't get in. It's a private club, and it's made for celebrities, so they don't get bothered by fans. So they said, we'll fix it up. What night would you like to go? And so we went there one night, and it was a little club below the street. You had to go down steps, and you know, darkened little club. But we walked in and signed our names in, and like the kid I was, I just said, is there anyone famous here tonight? And he said, well, Michael Caine was here earlier, and he said, Paul's here. And so, you know, of course, I said, Paul McCartney, right? He said, yes. And we went in the club. And the club was odd because it was divided into two sections. It had a section with a little stage for a local group to be entertaining and tables and people having drinks. And a separate section that was glassed off where you could go in and it was quieter and you could have dinner. And after sitting in the club part of it for a while, the door from the restaurant area opened and out came Paul. So we were just, you know, it's just, I don't know how to describe it. We were just stunned. I mean, I don't think I saw him first. I think Bob said, that's Paul. And they all, of course, pushed at me and said, go talk to, go say something. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm in the middle of the floor and he's 6 feet from me and I don't know what I'm doing. They're going, go ask him something. Go ask him. And, you know, the cowards, I pushed my way forward and I just walked up and just rattled it off quickly. I said, excuse me, Paul, we're a group from the United States. We're going to be recording here and we're huge fans. We just wondered if you might have a minute to answer some questions. And he could not have been nicer. He just, he smiled and said, oh yeah, sure. And he kind of leaned back against the glass that separated the two rooms. And we all just kind of, you know, hovered around him and asked, threw questions at him. And you know, he answered guitar questions and things like that. And then one of the members of the group reached over my shoulder and said, Paul, I know this is a lot to ask, but could you sign this? And gave him an Erevance card. And he took it and said, oh, it's a lot to ask, and laughed and started signing it. And he gave it back to Nolan. And, you know, after a decent amount of time, we thanked him profusely and went back to our table, shaking our heads, our whole bodies
vibrating.
And, oh, my gosh. And then the worst happened. My mom was there, and she said, well, this would be great. We'll have it in our official scrapbook and blah, blah, blah. And Nolan said, hey, I asked for the autograph. It's not going in any scrapbook. It's going with me. Mm-hmm. And we all, you know, it's just, and I understand his thinking, and we all were just crestfallen. And I just, you know, instead of being sad about it, I got mad about it. I said, this is my one chance to meet one of the Beatles, and I'm not going to have his autograph. Yeah. So we waited until the club closed and the lights came up, probably 2 a.m. or whatever. And so when he came out, I brought 3 cards back to him, and I said, Paul, I'm so sorry, but my bass player is getting a little possessive, I remember saying.
So we want to make sure that we get to the release of the album. In the early 2000s, a rep from RPM Records finally gave you a call to let you know that the bootleg CD copy of the songs you recorded in 1969, a year after the anecdote you were sharing, was being sold at $40 and $50 in London record stores. So this April, though, is the first time Resurrection is being released on vinyl. In the last minute that we have here, I mean, what does the vinyl release of the Erivans recording from 1969 mean to you?
I think it really just is finally going to be heard the way it was meant to be heard. I have had a vinyl of it since back then that EMI gave us a few test pressings and all that, but nobody else has really heard it on vinyl. And, you know, it isn't a modern recording meant to sound like it was recorded a week ago on high-end CD, digital, Pro Tools, whatever. It's, you know, it's meant to be sounding like its era. And so this will be the biggest thing that this release that Joe has done accomplishes.
Tom Hartman is the leader of the Erivans, a St. Louis band whose album will be released on vinyl on April 20th. Congratulations on that finally happening for you.
Thanks so much.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyle.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, committed to conservation and careful management of the state's forests to make them more resilient and better habitats for wildlife. ChooseWood.com.